Welcome, podcast listeners, to another episode of the Rational Face Podcast, best podcast on the Blabbernacle.
Yeah, you keep getting that wrong, like we're this, like, jello. I mean, we could be the Blabbernacle as well.
Yeah, we're blobs, that's fine. I am Brian Dillman.
And I am Brian Kissel.
In this episode, Laurel and I talk with Dr. Jennifer Finlayson-Fife about two questions that came up. One is a concern that a listener had about the teaching going on in her ward of chastity for the young women. And to put it in the questioner's words, the idea of the young women's president or the young women's presidency was to scare the crap out of them so they never make a mistake or never dare make a mistake. And so that's one approach, but Dr. Jennifer Finlayson-Fife offers some other ways to talk about sexuality for teenagers, especially teenage girls. The second question is one we haven't dealt with at all yet, I don't think. It's about pornography and how to deal with pornography. I've heard this talked about in other podcasts, yeah. And the takeaway message seemed to be don't shame, because you'll end up putting someone into a shame cycle, and they'll soothe themselves when they're feeling really bad by consuming more pornography, and then they'll feel bad about that, and so they'll soothe themselves again, and it's very hard for them to get out of that cycle. In this discussion, Dr. Jen offers some really thoughtful ways to at least think about pornography, a way to think about it more fully than good and evil, right? And also, as a content warning for listeners, in that discussion, we don't focus on it a lot, but we do bring up the idea of pornography being linked to human trafficking and sexual abuse, and we talk about addiction. And so if those things are triggers for you, then don't listen to the second half of the podcast. So that's what we've got on the table today. Let's jump right in.
Very good.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our fifth installment of Ask Dr. Jennifer Finlayson-Fife. I'm Laurel, and I'm here with both Brian and Dr. Finlayson-Fife. So say hello, kids.
Hello.
Hello.
So if you're not familiar with it, Dr. Finlayson-Fife is a sex therapist that specializes in LDS families and couples, and we just field questions that are given to us, and she answers them. So I'll start with our first one. And apologies to the listeners. I've got a kid in the bathtub that you can probably hear singing and playing, but it's adorable. Anyways, here's our question. I'm friends with many of the young women's leaders in my ward. The other night, they were discussing a recent standards night activity where the young woman president was teaching about the law of chastity. To quote them, her tactic was to scare the crap out of them so that they wouldn't dream of having premarital sex, and explaining that sexual sin is second only to murder. I tried my best to explain why I felt that approach was harmful and not appropriate, but I wonder if you could address the best healthy and appropriate way to teach the law of chastity in a Mormon context to a group of young women. While I'm not sure the young woman president would be receptive to hearing your answer, I do believe several of the other leaders would be and could hopefully counter her discussion in a positive way if they heard it modeled for them. Could you help?
Okay, great. So this is a topic I care about a lot, is just how do we talk to our youth about sexuality, but in particular young women, because I think we have traditionally done such a bad job of it and created so many problems that is now my livelihood, but meaning a lot of couples that come to me and women in particular that have so much anxiety about their relationship to their sexuality. But, I mean, let me just, I think first just speak to the fact that I think culturally and not just in the church, just and the, you know, and humanity often has sort of a deep anxiety about sexuality and really this fear that sexuality is going to take you down, that it's kind of the, that to be sexual or to admit to being a sexual being is to be at risk for turning into a depraved and soulless person. And I think particularly our notions of what masculinity is and what femininity is, it's really counter to our notions of what a good woman should be or ought to be. And so, you know, I think if this desire to scare the crap out of them, to quote her, is about, like, you know, we're so afraid about the sexuality of our children and so afraid that they're going to express it or experiment with it. And of course, if your only goal is to just make sure they never have sex or that they never enjoy sex, then maybe that would be the right approach. But in reality, that's actually not a good approach, because even people that were tried, parents or leaders attempted to scare them straight, I actually believe they were less able to navigate dating relationships in my dissertation research. They were less able to advocate for what they wanted because there was so much anxiety and so little self-awareness and so little knowledge of how to act with wisdom and clarity in those moments. So even if your goal is keeping our children chaste, it's a really bad approach, the fear-based approach. And it's also, you know, if you're going to sort of inflict anxiety around a God-given, very human experience of sexual desire and arousal and pleasure, I actually think it's a kind of a violent thing to do, to disrupt a natural relationship to one's body and to a God-given experience, and to shame it and to basically insert anxiety into it. Now, that said, I believe that, you know, our sexuality is powerful. You know, it can cause great damage to somebody, how one uses their sexuality with another person, and it can also be a very uplifting and transcendent experience on the other extreme. So it's a very powerful currency, and so being wise in how you use it is very important. And teaching our youth how to be wise in how they engage with their sexuality, or how I like to think of it, is how do you bless your own life or someone else's life with this gift? And that's really what your goal is to have it be a force for good. So I think that we can both hold our ideals without inflicting shame, and we can encourage our adolescent children to be wise in their decision making without having them be terrified. And I think it means, you know, articulating, here's the standard that we hold dear, that we believe in, and that is that sexuality is God-given and blessed and wonderful, and it can be a wonderful thing. It isn't inherently good or bad. It depends on what you do with it. And that because it's such a powerful way to be in a relationship with another person, and because it has the power to bring a life into the world, it's intended to be in a marriage relationship or a committed relationship, right? So I think you can articulate the standards around sexuality without shaming the body's capacity for it, without shaming desire. I think we get too invested in the idea that desire is inherently a problem or arousal is inherently a problem. It just simply, not only is it not a problem, it's a problem if you don't have those feelings as an adolescent. And you don't want to shame the experience of them. The experience is good. What you do next matters. And whether or not it allows you to sort of integrate your sexuality and sort of be at peace with your sexuality or reject and push it away. So, you know, in my dissertation research, the women that did well, I asked everybody what their first experience of arousal was and how they related to it, what meaning they gave to it. And these are women that I interviewed from their premarital experiences into marriage. The women who saw their initial experiences with arousal or desire, you know, whether they were just, you know, one girl when she was young would sat on the head of her doll and her body responded to it. And she had a very negative response. What came into her mind was dirty, bad, you know, that she'd done something wrong just because her body responded and she stood up. And see, she wasn't able to see, as opposed to another woman that I interviewed whose first response was to say, like, oh, like, that's cool. Like, I have this cool capacity and, like, it's a good thing and I'm looking forward to being able to express it more fully. So, you know, how you relate to your body's capacity for arousal is very important. And then what you do with it is really important. So I think talking to young women about it's a good thing, your capacity for it's a wonderful thing, and there's nothing wrong with desire. There's not even anything wrong with arousal. I mean, it's just going to happen. But the choices that you make, they matter. And whether or not you basically what effect it's going to have on you or on the person you're in relationship with to respond to those feelings, that's the piece that you want to think about and look at. I also think it's important to talk to young women about like what it is they want instead of what it is that they should want. So we tend to talk to young women as if you're a good woman, you aren't sexual. And boys, the poor chaps, you know, they are sexual, but they've got to keep a lid on it until they get married. And so, therefore, it's the young women's responsibility to be the sober drivers, so to speak, and to manage not only their sexuality, but the boys' sexuality in how they dress and in how they behave and all that. And so we deeply burden young women and with a sense that they can't own their own sexuality, and then they have to also manage the boys. And so this navigation is always happening, or is often happening for young women in a frame that delegitimizes their sexuality and teaches them that they should be desirable to young men, but not too desirable, right? And so it really fosters this external reference. What does he want from me? Am I doing more than he thinks I should be doing? Am I doing less than he? Am I acting like a prude? If you know, if he wants me to go this far and I do, then is he going to think less of me? Do I need to go talk to the bishop? What does God think of me? And you know, many of the women that I interviewed when they talked about these early experiences were so focused outside of themselves that they weren't asking the question of what do I want? And what matters to me? And what do I believe is good for me in this situation? And the women who did the very best in my dissertation research had a very clear sense of what they wanted relative to the law of chastity and how they wanted to navigate those relationships. And they were paradoxically speaking about their desires. Their desires were first and foremost in their minds rather than the desires of others. They weren't driven by this sense of, oh, I need to keep myself chaste so this guy will, so that my husband someday will think I'm legitimate, or so that I'm a pure flower, not a crumpled flower for my future husband. That's not how they thought. The women who did the best thought in terms of the law of chastity is something that I value. I want to not have sex prior to marriage, and I also want my husband to choose the same. And this is something that is between me and God, not me and a future man. This is not about me being valuable. This is about how I want to relate to my sexuality before marriage. You know, I was asked to teach a young women's lesson a few years ago, and really the question I started with was, you know, here's the law of chastity. Here are the principles we believe in. And I want you to, you know, take a piece of paper and write and think about, like, what do these principles mean to you? What do you want for yourself with respect to the law of chastity? How would you like to live relative to this? How do you think it would benefit you? What do you think will be hard about it? And, you know, what do you think you would do for yourself if somebody wants you to go further than what you just articulated that you want? You know, what would be hard about it? Because I want them to start thinking about how do I basically claim what matters to me? And then we don't teach women well at all how to stand up for their desires in a context of being in a relationship with men, because we actually teach young women that they're nurturers by nature, that they accommodate the desires of others because they're so good and so Christ-like. And so many of the women in my dissertation research they didn't even want to go as far sexually as, say, their boyfriend was pressuring them to, but because they wanted to be desirable, they felt, you know, torn between, I want to be pure and chaste, but I don't want to be a prude, and I want him to like me, and I want him to desire me, and they just really had no, they really weren't in touch with what they wanted, and so they didn't have that strength and clarity that they desperately needed. And that's really to undermine young women's strength, and we don't want to do that to our young women. So having lessons that focus on, here are the principles that we're taught, what do they mean to you, what do you want? So when I was talking to the young women, you know, now, of course, they're saying it in the context of a classroom, so maybe they had different thoughts than what they were sharing, but, you know, these young women really expressed, and I was talking to the Laurels, they were talking about, like, really wanting, that they saw it as valuable to them to go into marriage and to wait until marriage to have sex, to marry someone who'd chosen similarly. And I think there's a lot of, I actually think the law of chastity, and it's one of the things I argue in my dissertation, works in women, to women's benefit if you take the sexism out of it. Because basically to ask men to domesticate their sexuality and to focus it on families, you know, women, because you get pregnant and you basically are going to have that child, if you have sex, it's yours, like, because you carry a disproportionate burden, that pressures you to domesticate your interests, right, to be family focused. Men aren't pressured in the same way. But if you have a social system that pressures men in that regard, then that tends, if you think from a sort of evolutionary psychology perspective, that benefits women. And so many women in my experience, they value the idea of committed sexuality. Now we've added a lot of sexism to it around making women desirable and, you know, keeping them chaste and pure and non-sexual, which is problematic and not theological, from our theology's perspective standpoint. But, I do think many or most young women want, a context of committed sexuality and like the law of chastity in that regard, and just allowing young women to take more ownership of that desire and of that wish and of that belief, and to allow them to stand up for what they want and to not be taking care of men's feelings all the time, which is what I spent time talking about in that lesson, and being willing to value themselves enough to stand up for what mattered to them and to stop trying to earn somebody else's validation. That's really how we best help women. And the women in my research that really did that, oriented to the law of chastity as something that benefited them, they did the very best. Not only did they do best in marriage, but they navigated dating relationships very successfully. The ones that were more guilt and fear-based, they did much more poorly in terms of just living the law of chastity, not to mention their own relationship to their dignity and their sense of self. So again, do either of you guys have questions about that?
Yeah, that's kind of a comment and a question. I think what you've described in this Laurels class, where sounded like it was a writing assignment, mm-hmm. or a thought experiment or something, mm-hmm. to instead of handing them what they should do or how they should think, mm-hmm. about their chastity, you gave them ownership of it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we've talked about this several times in this series, where we're talking about owning your own life or owning your own sexuality, being your own inner authority rather than looking for, mm-hmm. a quote or advice or something, but actually thinking and making that decision for yourself. And it makes sense to start in young women's and young men's and,
yes.
and find ways for them to own that, because I think, you know, when you've already gone through that and you've been taught the fear-based way, it's harder to, you know, hear a podcast or read a blog post or hear a TED talk or something. And for the moment, or maybe for the next couple of days, you feel really good and you feel empowered. Mm-hmm. But then the shame comes back in. So what, maybe my question is, what are some other devices or practices or exercises that one could do to point them towards being their own authority and owning their sexuality? Mm. Say if they are an older teen or a young adult, what are some exercises similar to your Laurel's lesson?
So maybe I have a couple thoughts about that. I think that we have culturally in the church, and we're not alone in this, is like just human, but is that we are, just from a sort of moral development perspective, we're very focused and fixated on sort of compliance and being good girls and boys and kind of following the rules as the measure of goodness or the way into goodness. And I think there certainly is room for having rules or principles or a structure, of course, but this element of ownership of self is, I think, extraordinarily important to moral development and to truly being a good person, because you're getting outside of the frame of what everybody else wants from you, and you're asserting your own choices and taking ownership of that process. So I guess my point is that in some ways I wish we would do this from primary on, which is allowing less intensity around obedience principles and frames, and more around choice and agency and who do I want to be. And we do this at church too, which is good, but goal-based and self, defining a self in terms of who am I going to be on this planet and what do I want to create and become. And we do those elements at church. I just wish we would do more of them. So, you know, goal setting and defining who I want to be in the world relative to the principles that I've been taught, any of the exercises that facilitate that, I think are very powerful and very important. And it doesn't have to be in a formal, you know, writing it out, but it may be more the way that we engage our conversations with the young women. I've taught in young women's for a number of years, and I was always asking them things like, you know, what does this principle mean to you? Why do you think God would teach it to us? And I mean, I wasn't just looking for a canned response. I was really looking for, I wanted them to grapple with the ideas more, to be able to discern for themselves what felt true and to take deeper ownership of truth. And so I think being less like we have to like cram ideas down our kids' throats, and more around teaching them true principles and letting them govern themselves, teaching them true ideas, and then allowing them the process of grappling with and experimenting with those ideas and being less afraid of that process of growth. So I know I'm giving you kind of a global response, but keeping a sort of agency and ownership frame on our lessons, I think, is important.
Yeah, I think that's good. And in my experience teaching the young men, the one thing that I think would be good is what you did. It sounded like what you did. Maybe I misheard, mm-hmm. but you didn't say, okay, now give me the answer.
Yeah.
You know, that like, I kind of think to get real thought going,
right,
you have to say, I don't want to hear your answers out loud. I want you to stew on this inside your head for a minute. Because as soon as they have to verbalize something to their group, that's going to shape how they're going to even think about it, let alone what they're going to be willing to divulge.
That's right.
So that might be a good thing with, I don't know, I guess with your kids to some degree, or depending on how comfortable the group is and how comfortable they are with being open with each other. You know, probably at least one question per class could be, you know, just think about this.
Absolutely.
Think about it inside your head.
Absolutely. And, you know, right, I think we have a lot of those things in church already, like journaling and goal setting. But I think what your point is well taken, which is like to keep the group reference a little bit less dominant so that you're able to really grapple with who you are and what you value and who you want to push yourself to be in the world.
I actually taught Gospel Essentials on obedience, and we had this big discussion on how obedience out of shame is not a good thing. because shame actually tries to take away agency in making you feel trapped or forced into a decision. Yeah, it was actually my husband brought up that point when we were listening last night to our last discussion, our last podcast, and he just was struck by this whole idea of shame actually seems to take away people's agency because then they don't feel like there's just a good and bad choice and they're going to be punished for making the wrong one.
Right.
So it's not really about them proactively taking a choice. It's reactively just defending themselves. And you don't become empowered. You don't become a fuller human being by doing that. You just feel like you're fending off all the bad stuff, but not really growing.
Right.
And so we talked about that today in Gospel Essentials, that real obedience has to have agency and has to have us, you know, making an active choice, that we are completely choosing this of our own free will and out of a desire, as opposed to feeling like we're being forced to do something because we're scared.
Right. I did an interview with Christine Haglund, the editor of Dialogue, that was just published last week on the issue of integrity. And I talk a lot about this idea of obedience that I actually wish we would use different language, because I think what we value is I won't get into it now. I'll take too long. But I think the language of obedience is actually problematic because of the issue of responsibility, and where I think integrity or submitting to principles or submitting to truth is a function of integrity, and I think it's a better word than obedience, because it keeps the ownership of the choice on the chooser. It keeps the responsibility of the choice on the chooser. And I think it's better in pressuring our ongoing moral development rather than constantly looking to what, you know, somebody else says we should do or think. But anyway, that's for another discussion. So
yeah, no, I just thought it was really interesting how it ties into, especially the law of chastity. And I mean, that was kind of actually the discussion we had last time, is what even prompted that thought from my husband that then I expounded on in class, of, you know, the importance of making a choice, you know, whether it's in regards to chastity or any of the other commandments that we have, that you're much more effective at it if you view it as your choice and not
absolutely
not something you've been shamed into doing, and that you can actually keep the commandments more effectively without the shame.
So this next question is about pornography and how we can deal with it. Nobody goes around saying they love pornography, at least not in the church. But it's there, it's easy to access. It seems that avoiding porn is taught in several ways. And in church, the most common way is that it's wrong. It's wrong because God said so, and it comes with all sorts of problems. And there's often slippery slope messages, like it will ruin your marriage, it will ruin your work life through becoming addicted. And then the next way that it's taught to, as far as avoiding pornography, is that it will mess up your sex life by causing erectile dysfunction or the inability to become aroused normally. And more recently, there's been some social media that is sharing the fact that it is linked to human sex trafficking and abuse. Mm-hmm. So therefore, by purchasing or even clicking on pornography, the viewer is supporting an obviously awful, violent, and evil industry. Mm-hmm. So the question is, are these the only ways to talk about porn? Which way is the most effective? How does one escape the shame cycle of porn in order to get away from porn?
Okay, good. This is like, there's so much to say that I'm afraid of getting lost in my own thoughts. So please come in and ask for clarification or something if you need to. But But I think where I would probably start with it is that I think we, again, similar to the young women's lessons, we're so anxious about sexuality and arousal and eroticism. And again, you know, you can be in a marriage and family PhD program and they'll have one course on sexuality. Okay, this is not just a Mormon problem. There is a lot of anxiety about sexuality because it's such an intimate and vulnerable way to be in relationship with other people. So I think that the dialogue around pornography is very polarized, and it's hard to figure out how to relate to it in healthy ways. So again, there's a lot of shame-based tactics, fear-based tactics around it. I do think, though, that it's important. I mean, I think the way that I would think about talking to my kids about it and even to adults about it is that the fact that we get aroused when we see visual stimuli is, there's nothing wrong with that. That's just normal. And, you know, sometimes I've given the example that, you know, when I was 9 or 10 years old, my father had a book on his top shelf called The Naked Communist. It was a Leon Clausen book. I can't remember how you say his name, Scousen something. It was about, you know, so it's called The Naked Communist, and I, you know, scaled my father's bookshelf to get it down, and I opened it up, and there was not a single picture of a naked communist inside. thank goodness, but but anyway, you know, and then was telling my brother that story, and he was like, oh yeah, I did the same thing. And then I even went around the corner and found my sister climbing up to get it. And he's like, don't bother, there's no pictures. So, you know, it's just a very human tendency to be curious, to find it stimulating, to see, you know, graphic images. And I don't think there's anything problematic about that fact. Inherently, and I think sometimes we, you know, I've read some conference talks and so on that say, like, anything that arouses the body, visually is pornography and is filth. I think it's just too global of a statement and not particularly helpful. Because is it always wrong to involve any kind of third, you know, so any kind of material, whether reading material or visual material that might be arousing, does that mean it's always wrong? Also, to say like that it's all filth, which is, I won't give the exact quote right now and who said it, but I think that's not fair because you have, you know, a beautiful woman scantily clad lying on a beach all the way to pornography of I don't even want to say it, but, you know, raping children. Okay. So there's a huge range of what people find arousing. And I think that arousal is not the problem. The problem is what we find arousing and what it says about our sort of erotic blueprint and how we relate to humanity. And that's often something we don't even want to really think about or deal with. What are the sort of the templates that are arousing to us? What are the arousal patterns that we are drawn to? And are they related to how we relate to ourselves and others? And so I guess my approach to it is to say there's nothing wrong with the fact that you feel that way. I think the question is whether or not you're going to make that your life, or you're going to have a relationship with pornography or not. And I think there's a lot of factors in thinking about whether or not you would have a relationship to pornography that include what got brought up in the question, the industry itself, which is highly problematic, the empathy element, which I think if there's a more healthier way to think about it, it's to think about that these are actual people. You know, I think that for many people, the idea that you can sort of just objectify and dehumanize actually makes it easier to feel aroused. But am I comfortable with my objectification and dehumanization of another person? And many of us are comfortable with doing that. That's not to say that if we would confront it in ourselves, we would continue to be comfortable with it. But it's our ability to sort of reduce that person to just a sexual object for our gratification that allows us to be turned on by it. I think the other problem with pornography is that particularly if you encounter it at a young age and you develop your arousal patterns around it and you develop your eroticism around it, that again, to this, some of these points that were made, it's a little bit like being brought up on chocolate cake. You know, you never actually learn what it is to be in a healthy relationship to food because you were constantly being given cotton candy and, you know, M&Ms and cake. And that while there's pleasure in it, it actually distorts your palate and distorts your ability to be in a healthy relationship to a really fundamental human experience.
I have friends who work with victims of human trafficking, you know, and prostitution, and and one of the effective ways that they've found to deal with the men who hire prostitutes is that they actually meet former prostitutes, and the prostitutes basically put them through an education school of what they have gone through, and it completely changes the way they see it. Like, and the reactivation rate is like less than 5%.
Right.
Because it, you know, and to me, it is this question of, you know, like people, I guess I would have a question or just, I'm curious. I've noticed in the church that sometimes, when we talk about ideal relationships and ideal marriages and ideal things, we kind of turn people into objects. They may not even be sex objects, but they are other. They are this thing we get so that we can fulfill our destiny. Our, you know, men need a good, loving wife. Women need a good, protective husband or whatever. And it almost becomes like we just need this thing so that we can have this perfect scenario. But we don't really talk about, no, I need a partner that is going to call me on my crap and also make me happy and, you know, all these different things, and have a complex relationship with me. That is ultimately incredibly satisfying, but also challenging and nuanced and all of these things. And so for me, I wonder if some of that is, you know, we have a culture that often commodifies people, even if it's not sexually. And if, you know, if there's certain aspects, I think there's certain aspects of church culture that do a great job at humanizing people, and others that do not. And I'm just wondering if some of that might play into some of the pornography problems we have, especially when we talk about, like, I've just noticed when men are addressed about the porn problem, women suddenly become this, like, mass object. It's like, you are doing this to women. And all women are this thing. They're these other things, as opposed to you're doing this to some people.
Yeah.
That are women, usually. But these aren't some other creature that you're doing this to. These are fellow human beings. As opposed to, oh, you're taking these poor creatures off their pedestal and making them into whores. It's like, no, these are human beings that have lives.
No, it's very interesting what you're saying. I have never thought about it in the way that you're talking about, but I think, you know, it's absolutely true in just sort of the larger discourse around sexuality and women. We tend to see men as the sexual subjects and women as the sexual objects. That's why we so much focus on modesty and keeping ourselves, you know, not tempting for these poor guys. And that the pornography discourse is an extension of that, and it's often offered in this sort of, let's protect the women, so to speak, and I don't want to be dismissive of that to any degree that that's sincere, but it is in a way of kind of like it's focused around, in some ways you could even argue there's some contempt for women in the way we talk about it, because it's so much centered around male purity as sort of the essence of spiritual progression for men, and that women are the temptresses in that. And so pornography is a problem and it's filthy and it's devaluing of women, but I agree with what you're saying. It's not really speaking to the dehumanization of women, of real women, and making it more real, how women, men relate to women in general and their sexuality in general. Because, you know, I think often the way that, you know, clients that I talk to think in pornography is that it is a way to be in a kind of invulnerable relationship to a female and to sort of imagine she's there for you, or she's there, you know, without you really having to humanize her or be obligated to her in any way. And I think that part of, you know, I may be wrong about this, but I think part of the reason it's such a problem in LDS culture is the shaming of sexuality and the profound anxiety that we have around it, coupled with some of the misogyny that I think is inherent to some of the messages around sexuality. And so, you know, the dehumanizing that I see my clients do towards their wives, and in subtle ways, but not so subtle for the wife, meaning she feels that she's seen as someone who should be there for him, but not really as a partner and as a friend. Someone who should manage his sexual urges, but not really someone who also is sexual and has sexual wishes and desires. And so a lot of that sort of male sexual entitlement gets played out in marriages, and I think is often what's being expressed in a lot of pornography use. And I still say that at the same time that I don't want to vilify finding graphic images appealing as much as I feel like happens sometimes in our discourse. So I'm trying to sort of hold that there's both normalcy in it, but also we can be responsible in how we relate to it.
Yeah, I think that's part of the struggle I've seen people have in this, is that it's like, it's become so, you know, it's become so twisted in that I feel like pornography and the culture that we've created has gone so far down a certain path that we took something that was kind of neutral, you know, like sex is pretty neutral. And then because we got so weird about it, and I will say there is one other question I had, and that is the disturbing trend I'm seeing towards more violent pornography, and pornography that is intentionally demeaning.
Yeah.
Like you know, you have like 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, even when I'm searching something online and something else pops up and you're like, what? and knowing that there's whole communities that just flock around this, and this is outside of LDS culture as well, but
sure.
You know, I don't know, you know, I don't know what type of pornography is being viewed by LDS men, but
yeah.
I do know from, you know, some of the studies I've done too, is that porn, it starts to get, it just seems to tend to get more and more violent and more about control and violence.
Right.
As opposed to just, ooh, this is arousing.
Right, which is this issue of sort of erotic maps and sort of what it turns you on. And does it turn you on, the idea of basically, you know, harming another person? Which is, it's hard to get our head around, I think, the idea that that is a turn on for some people, but for some people it is. And, you know, what is it? Am I comfortable with the arousal patterns that engage me? So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there's not only there is an industry that supports it, but then, see, because I do think, you know, we have a very unusual problem, in that we have more sexually explicit material than the human mind has evolved to be able to handle.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a little bit like junk food, you know, that we have companies that create foods that are designed to sort of trigger the pleasure centers in our brain in a way that it's very hard to resist it, because it's designed specifically to be appealing, and yet it's really not good for you. And I think of pornography as the same way. And so I think you can get sort of sucked into an experience that is very compelling, and you can squander tons of time, and it's very incongruent with your moral positions in life. And, you know, you used to have to go out and be willing to commit to buying a magazine. Now it's just a click away, and you can be in an entire world, you know, viewing people having sex and so on. And so it really is a unique struggle that many people face. And I think much like our relationship to food and sexuality, it's about being willing to kind of assert, you know, in some ways we live in a culture where we sort of think the idea of censoring is inherently negative, that, you know, we want this idea of freedom and the freedom to pursue what matters to us. But when you have such freely available material that's not necessarily good for the human psyche or our spiritual development, it is a challenge. Now, I mean, can I both see it as a challenge and see, you know, that I can be sucked into something? What do I need to do to basically understand it's human to want it? It doesn't make me defective, but it may not be productive or good for my relationship or good for anything to let myself go in that direction. So again, I think similar to the chastity lessons is less shame and more choice. Like, I'm not just going to make myself a bad person because I like chocolate cake, but I might want to not have it around the house because I don't like how I feel when I eat chocolate cake all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if I sit around saying just the fact that I even want chocolate cake makes me a horrible human being, then I probably would be eating a lot more of it.
I think it's important to acknowledge the diversity and the spectrum of what might be called pornography. And as you indicated early on, to be reflective about what you're responding to and how you feel about what you're responding to. And I was recalling what Laura was saying about shame and how it kind of causes you to get in this reactionary mode. Mm-hmm. And it seems like some of the objectified images, the dehumanization, it's us just reacting. It's not us choosing that this is what we want, and it's not authentic intimacy, but it's a biological reaction to whatever you're finding arousing. And that's why objectified images are used in advertising. Mm-hmm. And that made me think of the Killing Us Softly 4 trailer that's been shared around, that's about advertising the image of women, mm-hmm. You know, which we can share if people haven't seen that yet. But it's, you know, it shows that all around our world, not just definitely not the porn industry, but in selling beer or selling cars or whatever, we're using these very reactive images that are not human at all anymore, to give a stimuli, to give a response similar to wanting sugar or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And so I could see how someone might take time to be self-reflective about what they really want. Are they wanting real intimacy? You know, are they wanting a good, healthy diet? Or are they wanting to satisfy their craving? Mm-hmm. And, you know, give themselves time to think about that and be able to use their agency and make a choice about what they want, more so than simply reacting to what is available to them, what is readily available to them.
Exactly. You know, I'm a pretty health conscious person. I actually grew up in a home where my mom was quite health focused. We had tofu way before it was cool to eat tofu and so on. But you know, like, I sort of think of myself as I have to be countercultural if I'm going to be healthy and slender. I just have to be, because, you know, I just can't eat what's sort of typically available. So I make a proactive choice about what kind of foods come into the house. And similarly, a proactive choice around what our relationship is to media and to, you know, putting porn filters on the house and so on. But it's like, it's more like I'm going to create the environment to the best of my ability that I think is going to foster my healthy development and the healthy development of my children. And those are, it's not about that desiring junk food makes me a bad person, or finding pornography enticing doesn't inherently make me a bad person, but I'm going to make proactive decisions about what my relationship is going to be to those realities. Because, you know, letting the consumer culture drive it is a bad idea.
I've listened to a lot of the Mormon podcasts, and the most I've heard talk about pornography is don't shame, you know, mm-hmm. that you get caught in the shame cycle. So I think this is really useful as a very well articulated thinking out loud of how that works, of how we respond and what kind of choices we can make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find it also very empowering to talk about, you know, making, again, choices of your own will as opposed to just the reaction of just don't let it in, just don't do this. Like that, you know, it gives you a sense of a little more control, at least over yourself, even if you can't control the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's really important, because especially we talk about, the way we talk about sex is almost like it's so out of control, even among good people, we just can't control it.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that so damaging.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we're scared to integrate it into ourselves in any way.
Yeah. And maybe it would still be valuable to say this, because I don't know if I've said it in this conversation well or not, but I think that sexuality and eroticism and desire is not the problem. It's when we get into compulsive relationships to our sexuality or to food, for that matter, whatever, that it has more to do with anxiety, self-indulgence. You know, it's like, what are the choices that we're making? It's not the fact that food gives us pleasure or sex gives us pleasure. It's how are we going to relate to those things? Because are we going to integrate it in a way where it blesses our life and we use it to bless the lives of those we're in relationship with? Or are we going to use it to indulge and to sort of spiral into a kind of self-destruction? Okay. And that's, so I think it's problematic when we shame, you know, sexuality as opposed to what's our relationship to it. And that's where I wish we would shift the conversation a bit more. That said, I do want to say, you know, I understand that some people have a real struggle, and I don't want to minimize, like, if they just, you know, I don't want to minimize that for some people it feels they feel very trapped by this cycle that they get into of their own impulses and their own inability to sort of self-regulate. And, you know, obviously some people need more support and help to rework their relationship to sexuality and to sexually explicit materials, to be something that's more in line with what they believe is best for them and believe is right. But I sometimes think we start out in a shame frame that creates part of the very problem we're trying to solve.
All right. Well, thank you so much for another podcast, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's always fun to have you on. And listeners, as always, we'll take comments and take questions for future episodes, talking with our Mormon sex therapist, Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife. Leave them in the comments section. There will be an email where you can leave an anonymous message as well in the blog post. So let us know what other questions you'd like to have answered.
Well, that was very interesting. As I am always saying, it's so wonderful that Dr. Finlayson Fife is willing to come on and respond to some of these questions. It's always really interesting to dive more into this topic that I don't think we talk about enough. Brian, what are we going to be talking about next week?
Next week, we are going to continue with the science series. A week or two ago, we had Dr. J. Ward Moody, who is an astronomer from BYU,
yeah,
and talked about the Big Bang Theory. And so this next week, we're going to talk with Dr. Janie Radabaugh, who is a planetary scientist. And in her training as a planetary scientist, she ended up getting a master's degree in geology. So she knows quite a bit about geology.
Cool,
and
yeah,
we talk about an old Earth, you know, not the 6 days idea, 7,000 years or however long it is, but we talk about an old Earth, how we know it's old, what forces shape the surface of the Earth, how... I'm starting to get excited because I really like this subject.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a fascinating story how we came to understand the world as it, the physical world as it is now, through the lens of geology. And, you know, like most sciences, geology was not clear at all a couple hundred years ago. And as you'll hear in the episode, plate tectonics, the theory of plate tectonics, is a relatively recent understanding. It wasn't until the 40s that experiments were done by accident to discover plate tectonics, and, you know, several years or decades after that, it was accepted widely by the geological community. So it's a pretty neat story how all of this came together. So look forward to learning a little bit about geology.
Well, that is so interesting. I was wondering, do you talk to her about some of these kind of theories about the young Earth? Like, for example, where people will say, oh, well, it's because you have differing worlds and they're all thrown together, so that's why you have dinosaur bones. And do you guys challenge some of those kind of ideas as well in that interview? Or?
Yeah, we challenge those a little bit. What's been interesting as I've talked with these... scientists that are believers, that are, you know, they're all working at BYU. Steve Peck is next, by the way. They all have different things that they emphasize. They all are not tearing scriptures apart and thinking about the documentary hypothesis, you know. And so when I ask some of the questions about scripture, I realize that there's a diversity of thought about what needs to be emphasized, what is really problematic, how much we really need to focus on things that past prophets said, like Joseph Fielding Smith and the more fundamentalist way of thinking about scriptures, and how much that can be ignored. And that just sort of comes out in their responses of, okay, you're a scientist, you definitely believe in an old Earth. What about these scriptures? And in her responses, it's pretty clear that that stuff just doesn't weigh on her mind as much as it does for other people. And so it's interesting to see this diversity of thought and emphasis that, you know, some people like me, that stuff really hangs me up and bothers me, and I have to think through it in a different way. But for others, it's just a non-issue, really.
Yeah. One thing I'd maybe say is one of the first articles that I wrote for Rational Faiths was a piece that was about cafeteria Mormonism. And it's kind of a difficult term to want to embrace or use, especially because, like so many others, it's kind of used as this pejorative. But like the point that I am normally trying to get across when I'll describe myself as that, is just basically that there are so many differing perspectives within this world of Mormonism, and that like when I was younger, I was reading certain scriptures a little bit more than other scriptures, and I was really influenced by certain pieces of the gospel, and so I would focus on those things, and I'd listen to talks about certain things, and I'd gain a little bit stronger foundation in that area. And that's what I love about this series where we're trying to talk to scientists. It's not that we're trying to say, hey, look, here are the issues. Scientists, answer our questions. But give us all of the answers. This is the way that you have to view the gospel. But instead, look at all of these different people with different strengths, and look at their unique perspectives that they take, their own, I would say, kind of their own cafeteria Mormonism, where, because I would say everybody, including conservatives and the most Orthodox, everybody's kind of developing their own approaches to the gospel. And I think it's fascinating to be able to listen to each other and hear that, especially from individuals who understand a particular issue, and it can give us ideas of ways that we can respond to those things. Not necessarily that they will have all of the answers because, like, they focused on their area, you know, but I still think it's really valuable.
Yeah, it's good to just recognize you know, like your Sunstone series. Mormons really are diverse. I've got people in my ward that are lean very literalistic and very fundamentalist, and I'm nowhere near that right now, and there's people that are all in between that, and sometimes we feel like it's a monolithic personality that is a Mormon, but
yeah, and it doesn't mean that you're better than they are, or they're better than you, or one of you has the right approach. We're all just trying to learn the gospel, you know, and do the best we can with it.
Yeah. So look forward to that discussion. Actually, the majority of it is about geology, and I'll nerd out on it. But the last bit's about scripture, and you know, we'll hear her take on it. So look forward to that next week.
Wonderful. Thank you, and we'll see you in the next one.